Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Coming up on this week's show, Pringles pay tribute to the ZX Spectrum.
A Streets of Rage movie is on the way.
And we chat to id Software legend, Dave Taylor.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every weekend with our wonderful friends at Bitmap Books. Now, of course, this weekend, the ZX Spectrum celebrates its 40th birthday. So why don't you check out Sinclair ZX Spectrum, a visual compendium from Bitmap Books. This award-winning collection features over 100 games, taking you through the glory days of the Spectrum, stuff like The Hobbit, Hungry Horace, Flight Simulation, and tracing the history of Spectrum games with some of the most iconic titles. You can get that and the rest of their retro gaming books on their website at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 323, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast that each and every weekend takes you behind the scenes on the world of classic video games, brings you up to speed on all the happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology, and we bring you a very special guest. Now, before we get into what's coming up on this week's show, actually, we are crossing the big pond, live and direct from New York City. I don't know why I'm doing the accent.
Yes.
Ravi Abbott. If it sounds a bit different, Ravi's in America at the moment.
Yeah, I'm in Manhattan at the moment. I'm just watching Al Capone walk down the streets.
Oh, wow.
I'm walking here.
Yeah, I've been on a kind of tour of America, and I've still got a couple of weeks left. So, you know, I'm in my hotel room at the moment. You'll probably hear stuff going by, lots of sirens, and I think a helicopter above. Yeah, it's been really good fun.
If we don't hear them, I want Dan to edit it all in and just use like GTA 3 sound effects, like, just constantly through the show, just like really obnoxious.
I love the fact as well, there is a slight delay on the line, you know, like on satellite on TV.
There
you
is.
Know, they're trying to do the news. Yeah, there's like about a second delay. So yeah, hopefully, yeah, there won't be too many awkward silences. But yeah, Ravi, you've been all over the place. You were at Silicon Valley last week.
Yeah, I've been in the South to Georgia. I've been to Silicon Valley as well, and kind of checked that out. I saw the early Xerox PARC stuff, so I ended up seeing the first mouse that was kind of ever invented at the Computer History Museum. I even saw a private IBM collection, and this is mad. The guy gave me a kind of radioactive detector, you know, a Geiger counter. And he was like,
so you can take that on the plane coming back tonight.
Yeah, he was like, take that on the plane, you'll be fine. I'm like, I'm not going to New York with that on the plane. So it's going to be posted back. But
what did you do?
I was like, why do you have these?
Wow, so you've been really busy a couple of weeks. And obviously this week, I know you're off to VCF, aren't you, as well? The massive retro gaming and computer convention out there.
Yeah, so it's kind of a Commodore special. There's lots of developers there, and I'm hooking up with Amiga Bill, and we're going to go to VCF, and should be really good fun. My first kind of big vintage American retro show, and I'm hopefully going to be able to do the retro hour after hours from VCF, or the patron chat at least, which... should be pretty awesome.
Well, Ravi, we're very pleased that you took time out of your busy day, you know, flying all over the place to come and join us for the show as well. The joys of modern technology, eh?
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it?
Now, we have got a guest this week that we recorded a good few weeks ago before you went away. We had to kind of rack our brains and remember what we talked about. But this week, I remember this was such a good interview. We're joined by id Software legend Dave Taylor. And God, we went through so much in this interview, didn't we?
Yeah, so Dave's an absolute legend, and he was working with id Software kind of in the development of Quake as well as Doom and Doom 2. And he actually suffered from motion sickness, which was quite funny because the way that John Romero played the game and John Carmack, they were just crazy fast. And I think he had to have a sofa to lie down on after the kind of motion sickness happened.
It was interesting to hear about those kind of early days at id, you know, when they were playing like Doom, you know, when it was still in prototype on a LAN, weren't they? Imagine playing, you know, if you're going to play Doom against anyone in the world, imagine playing against Carmack and Romero.
Oh, that, would make you, and that like, would make you travel sick.
And like the developments that he talks about as well, like, I didn't know that Doom was developed on the next computer, and also the kind of ports that they did as well. So he talks a lot about the Linux ports. But there's an amazing story about the Jaguar ports and how they had to keep a cold Jaguar in the fridge and take it out when they were developing, because they were really actually pushing that hardware to its limits.
And, you know, I always love hearing stories from id Software as well. I mean, obviously, you know, we have John Romero on the show. I remember you went to see him in Ireland, didn't you, a few years ago? And we did an interview with him there. And, you know, we've covered the company quite a bit, but I think it's always interesting. Just when you talk about, you know, Doom, there isn't a game that I can think of that kind of changed the world, particularly, you know, insofar as the influence on modern gaming, like Doom. I mean, you know, really that was the foundation of modern first-person shooters for many people, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that kind of shareware model helped open it up, and that continued as well, because later on he did Abuse, which was an amazingly good little title as well. So we get into all the kind of Doom clones, but also Abuse and Quake.
And Lord of the Rings as well. We kind of get into Lord of the Rings, Battle for Middle Earth, RTS game. Yeah, so it was really interesting chat. So you're going to enjoy this week's guest. Dave Taylor is going to be on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, lots of news stories for us to jump into. I know you can't wait to talk about this one, Joe. It is happening. They're making a movie about your favorite video game franchise ever.
They are indeed. They are making Streets of Rage the movie. And I just, fingers crossed, it's good.
So give us a lowdown on this thing. Because, I mean, obviously, it's kind of been, you know, with the Sonic movies, you know, been out of the last couple of years, Sonic 2.
Yeah.
Everyone's kind of loving Sega movies at the moment, you could say.
So it's been everywhere this week. You know, I've seen it all over Facebook. Ravi, you know, texting me this morning, first thing I woke up to because he was still up. Have you seen this, Joe? Tagging me in it and everything.
like 3 a.m.
Yeah,
hour time,
I think it was something like that. So, yeah, so the script is written, and it's been written by John Wick creator Derek Kolstad. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the John Wick films. I've not seen the first one.
I've heard good stuff about the series.
Yeah, I've seen the first one, and they are right up my street, like action, you know, kind of fighting films and stuff, like action gunfighting films, like Gun Fu, you know. And I've only seen the first one. I keep meaning to check out the second and third one. It's just finding time, being a dad. I know I always say that. But it's been written by him, and then it's being produced by the same team who have actually produced the Sonic the Hedgehog movies, which is DJ2 Entertainment, and they're also behind the Equalizer franchise. But this guy, Derek Kolstad, has actually wrote quite a few game adaptations recently. So he's working on the Splinter Cell film, My Friend Pedro, Just Cause, Echo the Dolphin, and he's also doing the Japanese manga series Hellsing, like he's turning all of them into films, and now he's doing.
I'd love to see Streets of Rage. Like, how would that?
Yeah,
work?
I don't. Like, I kind of get Streets of Rage. Like, I get that. I can see that as a film concept. You know, based on the first game, like a corrupt city, and these, you know, the police are corrupt, so these cops take it into their own hands. Like, I can see that, and I can see it being a really good fighting film. Like, you know, if they do it in the vein of like The Raid. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but that was like I think it was a Korean film which came out about 10 years ago now. If they do it as like a really, really action-packed, non-stop, like adrenaline fighting film, I think it will work really well. But Echo the Dolphin, don't really see how that would work.
It'll be like Free Willy.
Yeah, maybe. Like, but I mean, the story of Echo the Dolphin is about aliens taking all the dolphins, isn't it? Or something. So
something random like that no one ever remembers.
Yeah, so I'm not too sure about that. But yeah, I mean, there's no release date or anything like that. There's no like castings or anything, but it's in production, it's wrote, it's been approved, and there's a production team, you know. In the Sonic the Hedgehog films, like, although they're kind of aimed at children and stuff like that, they've done really well, haven't they? And they're massive, you know. Sonic the Hedgehog 2 is like the biggest film in the world at the moment, I think.
Yeah, and I think from everyone I know, it's kind of dads who've dragged their kids along to see
it.
The kids have enjoyed it, but it's really the dads who want to see it mostly.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel like with the person who's wrote the Streets of Rage film, I'm hoping they're going for the whole, like, it's going to be an 18 or a 15. It's going to be a violent action film like John Wick. I can't imagine it being, like, a children's film.
See, I'm hoping,
maybe adult, well, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Streets of Rage 4, that still kind of had that kind of early 90s aesthetic, didn't it, to it? Which I'm hoping it's going to kind of be set around, like, you know, 1991, 92.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think of that. I'm the same now. Now you've mentioned it, I hope it is set in 91, and I'm thinking about it now. I'm trying to think of it as a film, and I keep thinking of RoboCop. I keep seeing Robo.
Exactly,
I keep seeing RoboCop, like, you know, with the police chief and everything, like in the police station. I really hope that's like how they do it.
And there's really camp like cyberpunks on the corners of the streets.
Yeah. They what are they called? The splatterpunks. Yeah.
Waiting with crowbars.
You're gonna have to
down.
Be. Attacked by prostitutes in it as well. That's a key part of the game.
That should be a key part of it. So I'm sure.
I thought Ravi was just describing his afternoon in New York.
I'm sure I'll be reporting on it every week until it comes out, or at least whenever we see any information about it. So fingers crossed. It's as good as the Sonic films and the John Wick films, and better than the most recent Resident Evil film.
I was going to say, you know, if we're talking about, you know, movie adaptations of Sega franchises, it does kind of seem like, you know, they're on a good path at the moment with that crew involved as well. It could be a good one.
Yeah, it could be a good one.
So, as soon as we get the trailer, of course, we'll stick that on our socials as well. Now, this weekend, it is, you know, a big celebration for fans of 8-bit micros here in the UK. The Sinclair ZX Spectrum celebrates its 40th birthday tomorrow. At the time when the show comes out. So it's going to be on Saturday, the 23rd of April, 40 years since the Spectrum made its debut. And I thought this was really cool. Pringles. Now, you know, I can munch down a tube of Pringles in one sitting when I'm gaming dead easy. But they've actually done a little post earlier this week on Pringles UK and Ireland's Twitter account, where they're saying, this is a tribute to the original gamers, the OGs who've stayed in the game since gaming began. Now, it was a bit cryptic. It said, those who know, know. Those who don't, well, we get it if you opted for sound off, but watch this space. Now, have you guys seen this video?
Yeah.
They tweeted it?
I've watched it.
How do you describe it then, the tweet?
That it's kind of like they're going through stuff. So they're like, before Elon, before NFTs, before AR. And it pissed me off a bit because, VR was... They say before VR, and it was like VR was a concept years before in sci-fi, you know, the Spectrum and stuff. It seemed a bit like, just a bit kind of cheesy to me.
Well, a lot of people didn't know what this was about, because when you listen to it, and the audio is the most important part of this. Now, they don't mention the Spectrum or anything like that, but you actually see that kind of, you know, the flickery decompressed.
Well, they say there was Clive. They say there was Clive before all of this, which is... reference to Clive Sinclair, you know.
So then obviously someone thought, well, that sounds like the kind of sounds that a Spectrum made when it was loading a game back in the day. So what did some enterprising person do? Of course, they transferred that audio file onto a Spectrum and tried to load it.
All right.
It turns out the Pringles have actually made If you, there's a little YouTube video that I'll link up in our show notes as well. They've actually just done like a Pringles advert. It says mind popping. A Pringles can rendered on a ZX Spectrum to celebrate its 40th birthday. So they've actually made a program that you can run on the ZX Spectrum. Basically a Pringles advert that lands up on there.
Oh, I see. I was a bit confused because I obviously watched the normal trailer for it and then watched it with sound as well. And I was like, oh gosh. And I just assumed like, because I'm not a specky guy, you know, I just assumed it was, that was kind of like just what the Spectrum sounded like. Like, you know, obviously it is what it sounded like, but I just assumed that was like the peak performance of like music in the Spectrum. And I was like, oh God, kind of thing. So,
you thought people listened to that for pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty cool.
Some, you know, they do there will be loading sounds. Like, yeah, a lot of nostalgia for some people.
Well, actually, if you look a bit further down as well, they've actually done like a render of what a Spectrum-themed flavour might be as well of Pringles. And they're calling it sour cream and Clive.
Oh, yeah.
Flavoured Pringles, obviously after Clive Sinclair. So, I mean, it is nice to see, you know, obviously the Spectrum celebrating its 40th anniversary. A big deal to us retro fans, but, you know, for a giant company like Pringles, it's actually kind of cool to see them showing it some attention, I think, and actually going to the effort of making a Spectrum program that you can download and run.
There must be a CEO or somebody on the board of directors who's a big Spectrum fan at Pringles. Yeah.
It's fun as well because it's kind of like, you know, they are getting onto retro games, but I did get annoyed by the term OGs as well because I'm sure OGs wasn't around back then. So it does seem like a kind of let's jump on this retro gaming hype and kind of do it. And the Spectrum's an odd choice, isn't it? You know, you'd think they would have done something more universally appealing, like just sold more globally, but they seem to be, maybe they're targeting the UK audience here.
Yeah, well, this looks like it is just a UK account that's celebrating this, but yeah, I think it's quite a cool little idea though. And I think, you know, it's probably not something that many companies are going to latch on to because it is a bit of an obscure anniversary, I think, isn't it, for those outside the retro scene. So not something I'd expect from like a giant company like that.
Yeah, I think we're seeing more of this kind of associating with retro games. And you know, it shows that kind of retro gaming and computers are popular and of interest. Like, you know, maybe some kid seeing this is going to go, what? There was something before NFTs?
Yeah, life before NFTs. It was the Spectrum and Pringles.
Yeah, and I must admit, the advert did work on me. I'm really craving a pack of salt and vinegar Pringles now.
Oh, I am as well now. I should have said that.
Feel free to slip us some sponsor money there, Pringles. So yeah, if you want to check out that and download it onto your Spectrum as well. I mean, it's a really cool idea that you can run it on your original hardware. I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, this is something that I wasn't aware of, actually, Joe, but you found this story. And this is something I showed this to my wife earlier. I said, we'll have to watch this tonight on Netflix. Netflix have released a new horror movie that's about retro games gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, you know what? I was browsing Netflix last night, funny enough. And I said to my wife, let's watch a film. She never wants to watch films, ever. Mm. She never wants to watch anything together at the moment. Because it's always, you want to watch zombies or horror, Joe? And I said, let's watch a fun film. And I was going through it, and this Choose or Die came up. And I watched the trailer, and I went, can we watch that? And she went, no. So I haven't watched it yet. So I might have to probably watch it alone tonight. But it came out this week. And it's funny enough, because it's a Netflix-produced film. And it's very in the vein of Black Mirror Bandersnatch, which is obviously Netflix as well. And they're kind of saying it's like a mix between Black Mirror Bandersnatch and Jumanji, which is pretty cool.
Okay.
But from what I understand from the trailer and reading about the film, and it's got some good reviews, like people are saying it's pretty good by the looks of things. It's essentially about a young coder set in modern times who stumbles upon a text-based retro game. And essentially, it turns out that this retro game came out in like the early 80s and it had a prize for beating the game and nobody ever won the prize. So she's going back. She wants to win the prize money for it, essentially, you know, like 40 years later. But it's a point and click. It's a text-based adventure game.
Text adventure.
Adventure. And, you know, it's kind of like on the green, you know, black screen with the green writing. But essentially what happens is as she's playing it, it's a horror game and the things that are happening in the game start happening in real life, but then it gets like worse and worse and things, you know, she has to make type in the decision. So you say she has to choose or die, essentially. But it looks, as I've got, I used to be, I am a big horror film fan, but as I've got older, like I've become more squeamish, and from the trailer it looks pretty brutal. Like I won't because we're a family chat show here, we're a family podcast. It looks pretty violent from the things that she's having to pick to do, but it kind of reminded me of like Saw in the vein of that. But it was just,
oh, wow,
just really interesting that it was kind of totally based around the concept of finding a retro game and a retro competition, which we saw, you know, we used to see a lot of those things, you know, back in the 80s and stuff.
Sword Quest and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it was really in the vein of that. And the name of the game is, now, the game in the film, this is where I'm going
to... Cursor.
Cursor. Cursor. Yeah, Cursor, yeah. Spelt C-U.
As in a cursor on a screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it's starring the lad from Sex Education, which I haven't watched, but I know that's been a big show in the UK recently and stuff. So definitely looks like one to check out if you're up for a horror film and you're into retro games.
It looks like a kind of Ouija board. Like,
yeah.
Like you mentioned Jumanji there, and it's kind of like choose your destiny or fate.
Yeah.
The thing I think about it is like which game company would still actually have the money, right? Like most of them would have gone bankrupt.
Well, that's
the prize money, or they would have got nicked by a developer or something.
That's the point. I think the point of, I mean, I'm assuming here, I've not seen it, but it's demonic. It's a cursed game. Do you know what I mean? I don't think, obviously it's going to, I imagine it's going to be some sort of twist that it was made by a madman or something, you know, and it's got something to do with demons or Satan or something. I'm completely speculating there, because I've not watched it yet. But I mean, I don't know if you've watched the trailer, guys, but it does look brutal.
Yeah, I'm watching it right now, actually.
A lot of old tech in there.
In
the trailer. You know, there's like old VHS setups and stuff.
And CRTs and stuff, yeah. So
cool. They have quite
maybe we
a
should all watch
VHS
it. Watch it together, the three of us.
A watch party. Yeah. See who screams first.
Yeah, it'll be me for sure.
It's a pity. It's a pity it doesn't have the interactive element, though. Like, obviously, being called Choose or Die, that would be a really good kind of feature.
Yeah, maybe they wanted to stay away from that because it's obviously they made Bandersnatch as well. So, I mean, it's been a good, 4 years since that came out. So maybe it would have been time for another one. They've got the technology, haven't they? So,
the fact that this is a game, it would kind of be, you know, a logical thing for them to do that, I guess. It would have been quite cool to see. I've also found something quite creepy as well about kind of stories surrounding cursed media. You know, for me, it started with probably when I saw The Ring.
Yeah.
You know, that really creeped me out, the fact that there was like a, you know, haunted VHS tape. And more recently, there was the Archive 81 that we talked about on Netflix, which I read the other day has actually been cancelled. They left that on a cliffhanger. And apparently they're not doing series two, which is really bizarre considering it was like in the top five most watched Netflix shows when it was on. So
it also plays into like Polybius as well. And the title itself, you know, you've got like Skate or Die or Ski or Die, which was like an old series of games. So it's kind of relating to that.
Yeah, so that is available on Netflix now. I came out this week, so I'll put the trailer in our show notes at theretrohour.com. I'm loving those New York sirens.
I know,
in the background.
I didn't think we'd actually hear them, but they're there.
So this weekend, like we did say, I mean, Ravi is going to be doing our After Hours podcast and our patrons hang out live from VCF, because it is that weekend. You know, even though you're traveling, you're on holiday, you're still committing to the show. Ravi's still going to be here for our hangout that we do once a month. And this is something that we do on a Sunday evening for a couple of hours. We invite all our patrons to come on board and we just talk about all kinds of like retro, nostalgic, geeky stuff on that, don't we?
Oh, yeah. Like, I really love it, and it is like kind of a club, and I'm really excited to actually kind of be doing a video from VCF and, you know, maybe showing off some systems that will be there, and it's going to be a lot of developers and stuff. Get them involved, because it is just like a huge chat. And the thing is, a lot of people join it and show off their setups. So this one, I can go, look at this setup.
Yeah, you're going to be the one who's going to be like, look at this.
Totally alien. Yeah.
Yeah, normally everyone else has got kick-ass collections and we're really jealous, aren't we? But if Ravi's at VCF, that might be quite impressive. And you're also going to be recording our patrons' exclusive show that we do, which we haven't decided on a theme for this weekend's yet, but I'm sure we will soon. Our latest one's all about retro handhelds, isn't it, that came out last month. So we're going to be recording a new episode of our patrons-only podcast, The Retro Hour, After Hours, this coming Sunday. So if you join us on Patreon right now, very good time for you to join. You can join us for the hangout this weekend and get the patrons exclusive podcast, of which I think there are like, 22 episodes now? that you'll unlock if you join us on Patreon.
I always think it's like, oh, we've done like 10, 22. That's crazy.
Yeah, I think over 2 years worth of them that you can catch up on as well, covering all kinds of different stuff. So, but really the main reason that you'll join us on Patreon is just to support this podcast. Make sure it keeps coming out every single Friday. Covers all our costs of running it and everything too. You get the normal episode early most weeks. You get it ad-free as well. And on each normal episode of the podcast, you get extra content on the patrons version of it too. So definitely worth joining us. And if you do, you will find your place in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. And that is...
Hall of Fame!
No way!
What do you think of that?
He's got some music. It's only been, 5 years in the making?
The Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Now, we've only got a couple this week, but let's give a huge thank you to Ewan Wood...
Nova Lord,
who joined us on Patreon this week. We really appreciate your support, guys. And if you'd like to do the same, you'll find it at theretrohour.com. Epic music,
yeah. Use auto-tune on that, Dan.
All I heard.
No, that was you, just normal.
I just thought it was Ravi just shouting it and you played the music at the same time.
Hall of Fame.
A bit of echo on it.
Hall of Fame.
That's amazing.
Right, then, now, before we get into our chat with Dave Taylor, he's coming up in just a minute. A couple more news stories to just quickly jump into now. This is one that is a bit of a rumour, but I think it's probably quite likely to happen. This is that apparently Sega are planning on rebooting two of their classic franchises, Jet Set Radio and the big one, Crazy Taxi.
Yeah, so pretty exciting. Bit of a leak, been reported by Bloomberg. Bloomberg. Yeah. Apparently this is part of like the Sega Super Game that they announced last year, you know, kind of like off the back of selling a load of their arcade, you know, we've covered it, you know, they sold a lot of their arcade properties and stuff like that. And apparently it's part of this big getting back into, you know, home gaming and stuff for Sega. They're saying that these are going to be, you know, they're not just going to put these games out. These are going to be big games and they want them to be as big and as popular as Fortnite.
Sounds ambitious.
Which sounds really ambitious because Fortnite, I mean, as far as I know, I'm not down with the kids. It's still one of the biggest games in the world. And I just think, you know, we all love Crazy Taxi. We all love Jet Set Radio. But are they going to be able to compete? But we just don't know what they've got up their sleeves. You know, they could be full remakes, remasters, or are they going to go for like a huge battle royale version of Crazy Taxi hundreds of people online in one server driving around picking people up and stuff. I mean, maybe that's just speculation. I'm just making that up, but that actually sounds really cool now I've said it out loud.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they might make it free to play. We just don't know, but that's just my speculation with them saying they want it to be as popular and to compete with the likes of Fortnite.
I think that Jet Set Radio would really set itself well to an online kind of sandbox world where people had their own tags and they kind of took over areas and there was like different gangs and stuff. That could work really, really well.
Yeah.
And graphically, like they were pretty beautiful and like that kind of new shadery style that they did.
As you were literally just saying that all out loud, I was kind of like, you know what? I could see it suiting that kind of like Fortnite graphic, you know, aesthetic. I could see that for Crazy Taxi and Jet Set Radio. And, you know, the ideas that you've just came up for Jet Set Radio and the ideas I've just came up with for Crazy Taxi, I think Sega need to hire us, guys.
I think Crazy Taxi would be harder to do because what you'd have to do is, I always felt it was a really good game, but it was a very good, like, solo, you know, maybe you'd have to adapt that in some way. And also I felt that sponsorship kind of destroyed it a little bit for me.
Do you think
the fact that it was, you know, going to a KFC and it was doing all of that was cool back in the days, but now you have that in so many games. I think maybe Jet Set Radio Future in my eyes would be better for this kind of online world. And both of them have top soundtracks as well, you know.
Well, that was going to be my next point, the fact that, you know, I've played certain versions of re-releases of Crazy Taxi where the Offspring music's not in there. And to me, that was such a big part of the game. And I know it's something that a lot of games don't really bother doing these days, you know, using licensed music because they run into this problem when they want to do re-editions or remasters in a few years' time, that they've got to go through the record labels and re-license it and, you know, those contracts expire. But, yeah, if they haven't got, I mean, I don't know, you know, how much the Offspring are worth these days or, you know, whoever owns the music, I imagine maybe it's worth their while doing it if it's going to be a massive game. But it just feels like, you know, to me, without Offspring, it's not Crazy Taxi.
So you know, in Fortnite, they have a huge industry where they kind of make dancers and stuff like yeah. that. And they have all yeah. these add-ons that kids buy. Jet Set Radio, a huge part of it was dancing after you'd done the graffiti. And maybe they might integrate something like that. And hopefully it won't be too much of a sellout thing. But, you know, their Super Game Initiative says it's about generating recurring revenue sources.
NFTs. And,
yeah, something like selling yeah. dancers might be part of it, you know.
Yeah.
Or doing up your car in Crazy Taxi.
Yeah, you're not, you know, could be onto something there, Ravi. I guess, you know, if they hit the right market with the kids and they get, you know, the Jet Set Radio dance, because that Fortnite dance was everywhere a couple of years ago, wasn't it? So, you know,
I've got an 8-year-old nephew.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've got young adults at work who work for me who used to do it. So, and I'd just be like, what are you doing? It was Fortnite dance. And I'm like, bloody hell, you're 21, sit back down. But they could, if they tap into that market, it could be huge for them. So, you know, I've gone, in the last 5 minutes I was talking about this story, I've gone from not being convinced to going, this might work, actually.
To me, though, it's interesting that they choose basically, you know, 20-year-old franchises to try and reach this audience, which, like you said, is generally, I mean, you know, I don't know the exact demographic of a Fortnite player, but I'd assume it's kind of that pre-teen
audience, but really. I think Ravi could be onto something there with the aesthetic of the way it looks. You know, they could jump on that bandwagon and make it look like Fortnite with the the kind of new cel-shaded looking graphics. And then also with the whole...
way ahead of its time, you know?
Yeah, with the whole kind of like the dancing in it and the music in it and stuff like that, you know, they could go down... They could put licensed music in it, but go with a lot of modern, you know, rappers and stuff like that for it. So it could really, you know, really appeal to, like you say, preteens, early teenagers, and they could be onto something massive.
You know, with Crazy Taxi, though, for me, it kind of feels like it's not a game that I play for very long.
Yeah.
Not because I'm crap at it, mainly. I always die. But it's an arcade game, really, isn't it? You know, it was a coin muncher originally. So it doesn't feel like the kind of game where you're going to spend hours online.
You're on a set path. It's not got the free roaming that Jet Set Radio has. But imagine if, say, you could be a passenger and you were getting picked up by crazy taxis, or there was a different kind of aim in there as well. It's not just ragging around the city. There were different goals and stuff, and it was more of a like sandbox environment,
kind of like Grand Theft Auto when you're driving around, I guess.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting that one thing I'm really pleased is that, you know, Sega are actually looking back into their catalogue and using something that's not Sonic the Hedgehog, because it feels like now with the Sonic movies being so big, maybe it should have been a Sonic game, I don't know, but it's quite interesting kind of going back into there.
Yeah, they're probably done with him when it comes to games.
Yeah. It's quite refreshing to see something different from Sega. So, it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. I've got a feeling fans of the original may not be too pleased with the results, but, you know, we'll wait and see when it finally arrives. Now, before we get into our interview this week, there's one more story to quickly talk about as well. I mean, you know, we do say this whenever we talk about the Switch, that it really feels like the Nintendo Switch is becoming the go-to console for retro games, doesn't it? Because there's so much on there. And now it looks like we could be getting, and this, you know, makes perfect sense, a Game Boy Advance emulator on the Switch.
It does make sense, because obviously we recently got the N64 one, and then obviously we got the Mega Drive Genesis collection at the same time. But once again, we're all about rumours this week, aren't we?
Yeah.
This is leaked screenshots from the actual development team behind the Switch, you know, the development team behind, like, you know, the Nintendo and Super Nintendo emulation on there. It's all in Japanese, obviously, but there's essentially lists and lists of GBA games kind of embedded and trying to run them on the Switch. You know, we've got like Pokemon Pinball and Mario Bros. On there, and my eyes can't see the smaller ones, but we've got the Game Boy startup screen, you know, running on there as well. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know who's got a hold of this, but I'm seeing it everywhere, you know, that it's... These are the leaked images of it coming, so wouldn't be surprised if Nintendo have leaked it themselves, because I know what they're like. But it does seem like that would be the standard progression, that or the GameCube. But I feel like they still kind of release a lot of GameCube games on the Switch, and, you know, they still kind of revisit kind of some of those games. So I can't see that happening. But yeah, I think the Game Boy Advance, it just seems right for the Switch, doesn't it?
Well, this apparently leaked onto 4chan.
Oh, okay.
That's where it came from. And there's a Twitter account called Trash Bandicoot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about how apparently it was one of their developers who came onto 4chan, put a couple of screenshots up of it, but which to me, if this is someone who works internally for Nintendo on this, it seems a pretty brave thing for them to do, do a screenshot of their...
I was literally about to say, like, I can't see Nintendo not being behind that then. Like, yeah.
They no longer work for Nintendo.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you work for Nintendo and you're doing something like that, then what you're like, what kind of thing? Like, that's a bit, we know what Nintendo are like, so that's a bit of a crazy thing to do.
Apparently, on the leak, it says some of them have supposedly been in a ROM folder at some point, and they're kind of highlighted in yellow. So there's like a list of all the file names here, and there's stuff like Mario Party Advanced, Choo Choo Rocket, and interestingly, they're doing the Japanese region version of that, so it must be kind of like region unlocked. And there's quite a list of stuff going through there, and also some of them, like Pokemon Ruby, Sapphire, and Emerald, have been using a Link cable emulation as well.
Oh wow!
So there's some interesting looking stuff going on there, and maybe there might be an ability to link up with other gamers on the emulator. Hopefully, more will come of this.
I'm assuming they're going to modify it to online battling rather than, you know,
the original ROM. Probably.
Yeah, the original ROM will be like, you got to plug in your link cable now kind of thing, whereas they'll obviously go into that and change all the code and et cetera. So you just do
We know, they package these as like individual games rather than, you know, just releasing the whole emulator. So it'll probably be like a Pokemon package that you get. And
I don't know. With the Switch, they do like the NES emulator, and you click on it and you get all the NES games, and then they do it with the SNES.
And the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, and the Super Nintendo, the N64.
I don't have one, so.
Yeah. You pay the subscription monthly, and you go on to like the Super Nintendo, and there's like 40 games on there for you just to play. Like, you don't have to then pay. Okay. So I think that's what people are thinking they're going to be doing with this as well, with the Game Boy Advance. Now, don't get me wrong, there is games on there you can just buy individually as well. But I think this is edging more towards that it's just going to be a full-on Game Boy Advance emulator that you get part of your subscription like you do the other ones.
Which makes sense, because, I mean, you know, it's you know, these are games that were designed for handhelds anyway, and obviously the Switch, you know, even though I generally play it on a screen, I know most people use it handheld. Mm-hmm. And also we've got that timing of, you know, the 3DS and the Wii U stores closing as well. Yeah. So it would make sense that, you know, they want to kind of repackage those games onto a new system. And yeah, I'm looking at stuff here. The fact they're going to do stuff like random matchmaking and things as well, which would be amazing for like Game Boy games, which brings a whole new dimension to it, really, doesn't it? Because back in the day, you could only play it either at most with a link cable or generally just passing your console back and forth. Mm-hmm. So having random matchmaking on the Nintendo Online service would be pretty cool as well. So again, it kind of feels like we're moving down this direction. We talked about it, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and we talked a bit about, you know, Microsoft Game Pass and what Sony are doing now.
The
and Nintendo have got such a heritage, haven't they? So it would make the Switch, you know, the go-to platform for all Nintendo games.
Yeah, interesting.
It's an easy way to fill up, isn't it? Like, just look at your old libraries, get your old systems ported, and then you're sorted.
Although this was 4chan, so it could just be someone completely trolling who made it in Photoshop.
Yeah, and it's just gone viral, which is,
Also, equally as likely, let's be honest, but yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. Maybe Nintendo will see that and be like, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so, maybe.
We'll link that up. And everything else we talk about, you find all the stories. You don't have to Google around for them. They're all in our show notes every week on your podcast app, or you can get it from theretrohour.com. Right, next then, we're taking a trip back to the classic days of id Software, getting some incredible stories with our special guest this week, the wonderful Dave Taylor, next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
You're listening to the Retro Hour Podcast, and it is time for the main event then, when we welcome on this week's very special guest, a veteran of the video games industry, someone who's worked on massive franchises, games that we grew up playing, huge companies. I think our guest today ticks all of those boxes. Let's welcome on the incredible Dave Taylor. How are you doing, Dave?
Fine, man. Thanks for having me. This is brilliant.
Really appreciate you taking the time to do some reminiscing with us. Now, sure, you know, before we get into the companies that you've worked for and the games that you've worked on, it's always quite nice to kind of find out our guests, you know, geek credentials and kind of go back to day one. I mean, what was it that initially got you into gaming then? Do you remember your very first experience of a video game?
Oh, good Lord. I guess that would have been an arcade, Arnie's Arcade in Connecticut. Yeah, just pumping quarters into, you know, the old school coin-op games. And I was just instantly head over heels. And then I got a dose of, you know, finally convinced my dad to get us an Atari, cracked out on that. And then I had a friend down the street named Jason Keough, who had every single thing you could possibly imagine, every handheld, every console, and it was just like playtime over there. But even more importantly, I had a couple of friends who had Apple II Pluses. And I can't remember the sequence, because to me, it was just like a world of drugs that opened up before me, this incredible buffet. And, take your pick. And it was all just so fabulous. But it was really the Apple II games that I fell most deeply in love with. And the big titles for me were Ultima, Wizardry, the original Castle Wolfenstein, Rescue Raiders, stuff like that. A mix of things. Fantasy, action, sort of strategy, mix of stuff.
We've had so many developers on that have said the Apple II, especially in America, was a huge kind of influence. Did you end up then moving on to an Apple II yourself after the Atari?
Yeah, well, after an extremely long campaign of begging my dad, he relented in high school and got me a completely pimped out Apple IIe system. Had two disk drives, you see, and 128 kilobytes. Not 64 kilobytes kiddie stuff.
I bet that was expensive.
Oh, my God. But really, the super high pricey stuff was the dot matrix printer, which printed things.
But did you kind of convince him it was for schoolwork and stuff?
Oh, of course. I convinced him it was going to enrich me and do all the good things, and, you know, said whatever needed to be said. And I suppose it did.
Well, how did you start programming then?
Well, that would have been, let's see. Yeah, when my dad got me an Apple IIe, I started fiddling with BASIC, AppleSoft BASIC. And I think, like most kids my age who were starting to program, one of the first things I made was a dungeon master program that would help roll the dice and do the saving throw tables and the two hit tables and all that stuff for me. And then I moved on to a little painting program, you know, various things. Yeah, that's how I got started.
So, you know, these games you were making at home then, I mean, did you eventually get these published yourself? What was kind of your entrance into the industry?
So the first games I made were in college, and they were specifically for a programming contest. And the programming, it was called the IEEE CS. IEEE is a student organization and a larger professional organization for electrical engineering folks. And the IEEE CS subgroup is for the computer programmer types. And they had this state programming contest. And the way it worked was the organizers would make a game, and then the competitors would show up on the big day. They'd be shown the game, and they would have to write some AI to play the game on their behalf. So it was a programming contest where it's like, surprise, here's the game, and here's your routine that you get to program to control your duder. And now you're going to go head to head with the other, you know, programs and see who wins.
IEEE is still about, isn't it? I know a lot of people that are really into it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they do all kinds of important standards. And yeah, no, they're alive and kicking. So I think the first one I can remember is I worked on a sort of a surround snake game. You can't stop moving forward, but you can turn left or right. And the idea is to surround the other snake, sort of like Tron, if you played that, the Tron Light Cycles game. Your goal is basically just to surround the other snake. And every time you eat an apple, your snake grows longer. The snake tail grows longer. And that was on the PC under DOS, I believe. And that was my first game I worked on. And then I got really ambitious and I started what was called the National Programming Contest under the same organization. And it was the same idea, but instead of being on a single PC where you have two subroutines fighting it out, instead we got companies to donate fancy pants Unix workstations. And each team of three programmers had three workstations, and their AI would run, you know, they could have three of the same AI running on three stations, or they could have three different AI running on three workstations because they had three coders per team. And then it was a three versus three networked head-to-head game of AI versus AI. And then in the end, there would be this big, like, 48 player, you know, 16 teams of three? Yeah, 16 teams of three sort of all-out battle to see which team would survive of AIs. And those are the first games I worked on. And the very first one I did for the National Programming Contest was called Gobble. And you played Ma, Pa, or Squirt. And Ma was this big fat woman with a frying pan, and she had a lot of hit points and tremendous damage, but not very much reach. Pa was this skinny guy, and he had a hoe, and he had range, but it wasn't as damaging as Ma's frying pan. And then there was Squirt, who was a little kid, and he had a slingshot with crazy range, but very little damage. And in the middle of the screen, there was a turkey inside of a house, and there was a couple bushes near the house and some windows around the house, and you could use the bushes to hide so that they couldn't see you. And the goal was to get Ma, Pa, or Squirt in that house, grab the turkey, and bring it back to your porch before the other team does. It was a great lesson in and how hard it is to ship a game on the big day.
Because it sounds like, you know, you were doing some pretty advanced stuff, especially stuff with AI. I mean, you know, a lot of people we talked to like started making, you know, Space Invaders clones or something. That sounds like
you were pretty hard. I say AI, but I really just mean, you know, nothing that fancy. I just mean like computer controlled characters.
So did you decide at this stage that you wanted to make a full-time career in the industry then, or did you have any kind of other plans? And were your parents supportive? How did that kind of work?
Oh, I wanted to do it since I first played Ultima, and I heard about this character/real person, Lord British, a.k.a. Richard Garriott, and was immediately had man bro love for him. I thought, God, that would be so cool. I mean, you know, what kid wouldn't think that? Early on, I was like, this would just be the shit.
Well, how did you find out about id Software?
In college, in addition to the NPC stuff, I was working on a very early electronic game magazine called Game Bytes, spelled with a Y. It was shipped on floppy disk, and it was actually edited by the sadly late Ross Erickson, who was famous for helping to start and evangelize the Xbox Live Arcade program. And I was reviewing games at first because I thought, this is a way for me to get free games, and all I have to do is write my opinion about them. And then I very quickly realized I have to play even the awful games that I don't want to play. So I thought, well, I can use this as an excuse to meet my heroes. So I interviewed Richard Garriott. I was in Austin, Texas, and that's where Origin Systems was. And I was just over the moon with that. I asked him all the questions. I was completely fascinated. Chris Roberts was also there. So then I interviewed him. And, that was a fascinating technical interview for me. And then after that, I was out of Origin Systems Legends. But in Software, this scrappy little team in Dallas had just come out with Wolfenstein 3D, which I and everybody else was busy playing. And I would get particularly nauseous playing. But it was so interesting for me because even though I'd get nauseous, I'd still play it. So it was fascinating to me because it was so addictive, yet nauseating. And I was just fascinated by this pull that I would do it. And I hate being nauseous more than just about anything else. So I did this group phone call with the whole team interviewing them. And I couldn't really tell who was answering everything, because there were so many people on the other end of the line. But every time I asked a really geeky question, of course, there was this one dude who kept answering all like, how do you get direct access to the frame buffer, next step, stuff like that. And that would be Carmack. And the really friendly guy who's answering everything else that I liked to hear about was Jay Wilbur, the CEO. And after that interview, I wrote a whiny little email to Carmack, saying, oh, gee, how do I get into the game industry? I've been doing games down here. And I had timed it right. They needed help porting Wolf 3D to the Sega Genesis. And so he kind of made me an offer.
So did you move then to go start and work there?
No, actually, I said, please, no, because I've still got senior lab. And this is my last year in electrical engineering. He was trying to get me to leave school with just 3 months left. And I said, look, I'll study the Sega Genesis tech ref manual. And then when I'm out and I'm done with this, I'll be able to hit the ground running on this thing. And he kept pestering me over the summer, but I somehow held him off and managed to finish. And then by the time I got there, he was like, forget that. We're late on this Doom game, and I need your help on this instead. And so thankfully, I didn't have to work on that.
Well, when you got there, I mean, kind of describe the setup at id Software, in those Doom development days. What was the vibe like, and what kind of stuff, equipment were you using mainly?
So I was on a 4666, which was generally, I think it was 33 megahertz, 66 megahertz internal of the CPU. And I want to say it was like maybe 8 megabytes, maybe it was more of RAM. And then we all had Next Step machines, which were real operating systems running, a BSD variant of Unix. And I pretty quickly set up my own Linux box somewhere in there. I can't remember, but it was sort of your typical, as far as the office decor, it was a sort of nondescript black building in the middle of Mesquite, which is sort of a flat paved suburb of Dallas. Just pretty unremarkable, right next to this giant highway loop called 635. 5, if I recall. And, you know, across from a gigantic mall. And the office, you know, is that sort of short, super thin pile of carpet that loves to absorb coffee stains. That nasty ceiling that stains beautifully when it has a leak and turns, looks like like a toilet was leaking on it or something. You know what I'm talking about. So it really, there's no great shakes visually, but that definitely wasn't what I was distracted by. It was what was on the screen. I remember when I first interviewed down there, John Romero, who's just a total showman, gave me the demo. And really, there's no one better to demo anything because he picks up on your energy and he lets you do all the jumping up and down. And he was showing me an early version of Doom, and it didn't have all the bells and whistles yet. It just had sort of the basic visualization stuff. I remember thinking to myself, I can't believe this isn't a pre-rendered cinematic. And I was just kind of, my mind was just blown looking at this thing, even though it wasn't really a game yet.
How important was the kind of next step operating system to the development? And had you used a next machine before?
I had used it before, but only from the command line. I mostly was on Sun workstations, but it was very much of a muchness. That's the beautiful thing about Unix, is that once you understand the command line, it's all kind of similar. And it was pivotal. Like, I wasn't there when they first developed their level editor in NextStep, but it was obvious from how it was made that it was just so helpful in getting them up to speed and having a really capable editor early on in the process. For me, because I was doing a lot of, writing DOS games back then really meant that you were finishing writing the operating system, because the DOS operating system wasn't really complete. And so you're essentially integrating a sound driver, a display driver, and, stuff like that, network driver in some cases. NextStep was a wonderful sanity check. Like, if I had a bug in DOS, well, it could be one of a zillion things. But if I had the same bug in NextStep, then it was almost certainly my fault, right? And the next step had the GDB debugger, which made debugging just so much easier than on DOS, which was really much more like what we would call an embedded system now, really more like a microcontroller almost.
Did it make it like easier porting to stuff? Because there was an Atari Falcon port and a Irix port as well at one point.
Yeah, so I did all the Unix ports, and that was just falling off a log easy. It was mostly just make. The sound code and the display code is all I really had to do. Carmack had already done a good job of isolating those parts of the code so that I didn't have to go crawling all over the code base to port them. And I just, I had enough experience with Unix that stuff was pretty straightforward to me. The Atari Jaguar stuff, those were nightmarish ports that would not have been possible without the genius of John Carmack. I just wouldn't have had the patience to do what he did. My job on the Jaguar stuff was like working on the sound code and the music engine. And I found that just miserably difficult. And I couldn't imagine having to deal with all the rest of it like John did. That was not possible because the game was portable. That was possible because John tied himself into knots to make it happen, because he thought it was a cool system architecture.
It was notorious to kind of develop for the Jaguar. We've had so many devs on that have said it was a real tough time when they were kind of creating stuff for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the architecture was totally heterogeneous and just nuts. There were crazy huge bugs. It would overheat. And on my sound code, one of the things John told me is like, oh, by the way, it can't reliably write to memory. What? You know? So, like, I had to treat two parts of the Jaguar like they were set, like it was network code, and I was sending UDP packets, and they might not show up intact, And the justification for the sound code was, every once in a while we'll just get a pop in the sound because it won't write the memory out reliably. That's like, okay, right? But the same chip was also, a huge part of the horsepower, the compute horsepower of the system. So, we were also trying to use it to do general computation. It was really, then it would overheat. We'd have to put it in the refrigerator or keep one in the fridge to take out, in case we overheated one. It was a mess.
See, at least you actually use a Jaguar hardware, though, because I know a lot of developers just like used a 68K and ignored all the extra stuff that was on there. But it did kind of prove that, if you made the effort and knew what you were doing. I mean, Doom on there was, probably its best game. A lot of the library was awful on the Jaguar, so it proved that with the right skills you could make something decent on there.
I didn't play any other games on there except for Trevor McFur, and I definitely believe you because I couldn't imagine anybody else going through the shit that John went through to make that happen. I do have fond memories from having implemented my first MIDI synthesizer on the Jaguar. So that I have as a happy memory, as well as working closely with Bobby Prince on that. So that was a very fond memory, but the rest of it was just horrific.
Well, you mentioned before, that you got some motion sickness when you're playing Wolfenstein 3D. Did you kind of, I think they called it, finding your FPS legs back then, didn't they? Did you kind of get over that when you started playing Doom, or were there any like tricks that you had to do not to like hurl when you were playing it?
No, it was a motivator for me to debug quickly, essentially. So interestingly, Doom and Wolfenstein weren't my favorite game genre, right? But playing Deathmatch, especially with Romero, was just so fun because to hear him just howl with delight at killing you and just his beautiful insults, his trash talking, it was just poetry. And Sean Green started to get really good at it. His joy playing it was infectious. So even though it made me nauseous, I would play as long as I could until I started. There were sort of phases for me. It was farting, sweating, and then wanting to throw up. And he would push me as hard as I could go. And then eventually I would get better and better at it. But I never really got super acclimated to it. It was always hard for me. I was much, much more interested in the coding challenge. I was in a panicky state because this was my first job out of college, and nobody told me that Carmack was, maybe one of the greatest programmers in the game industry. And so I just thought, well, what if he's just kind of typical and I'm completely stupid, right? So I was paddling frantically to keep from drowning in this, flood of self-esteem issues, because here was this dude just pulling away from me, already way more advanced than me as a coder, and pulling away at like this super linear rate, while I was frantically trying to keep up. And, so that was most of what was on my mind, like, Jesus Christ, how do I get anything done today to make myself a fraction as worthy as this person?
Well, when Doom kind of came out and, other people saw it, were you getting much feedback from the public? And what was the kind of reaction like? And how did you guys decide to follow it up with Doom 2?
Well, the reaction was nuts. People were pretty thrilled about it. My main interaction with folks, I guess, was through IRC channels, I think. And I started populating my .plan file. The folks at id didn't know about this finger command you could use to find, to essentially dump the contents of your user's .plan file. It was sort of like an early text-only version of blogging, right? So I started putting a couple of things in there. People started following it, and then some of the other guys started doing it, and then it kind of became a thing. And so, yeah, that was most of my interaction with folks. And I don't know, I was young and had self-esteem issues, and also, so I was doing all the embarrassing things one does with those sorts of things going through your head.
See, when Doom came out, I just remember it being such a phenomenon. It was the first time that I remember, because, I had a lot of friends who had Amiga computers. It was popular over here, but then they realized Doom wasn't coming out. They all sold up and got a PC. And it was the first time I remember people actually buying a new computer just to play one game. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah. I heard quite a bit about that myself. I was already doing that sort of thing for the Ultima games. It really kind of turned a corner with Doom and Quake. And I remember everybody started clamoring about, like, well, do you have one of these new fancy Pentiums? And they were, God, they're so fast. And if you use both of the UV pipes, you can get dual issue. And oh my God, and like that was a really exciting time for me as a coder and geek. That sort of stuff, it didn't land as much to me just because I wasn't really trying to keep up with the Joneses at home. I was happy with whatever computer they gave me at work. And and really, I hated DOS. I hated it. So I was spending as much time as possible in Linux or Next Step. I only used DOS to play games. And it was really sort of an awkward time where the games were getting good, but they still weren't as good as the greats from the Apple II days. There was this sort of awkward transition. And I was definitely playing some PC games, but I wasn't into FPSs, and I wasn't really
chasing the hardware upgrades.
Yeah, exactly.
That, well, there is a famous song on Doom 2, the Dave D. Taylor Blues. What's kind of the story behind that? I've always been quite curious about that track.
Oh, I don't know. That's probably just Bobby picking up on me. I was always complaining about something. It was probably something to do with that. I don't know. We really were dear friends, and just got along famously. And we spent a lot of time together on that Jaguar thing. And he was, just a lovely guy, just a lovely, lovely guy. And I thought he was such an interesting character. He was a lawyer before he became a musician. And he ran a halfway house for a while. And he had this great, wonderful Southern drawl to his voice. He was just kind of this complete package of fascinating to me. So I don't know if there was a specific story behind that. I think he just, I think like all of us, we just sort of pulled from our surroundings to name things or whatever. I did the same sort of thing with the cheat codes.
Well, you ended up working on Wolfenstein 3D as well, but there were ports for the Jag and the SNES and the Macintosh. How were you kind of involved with that? And what was it like going onto a Nintendo console?
Oh, I never played with that. I only worked on the Jaguar version. I don't know if they reused my MIDI sequencer for the other ports. So we had basically licensed a proprietary sound engine from Paul Radek, or licensed, I don't know, maybe it was, I guess it was work for hire, I don't know. But we had, he was an external contractor, and my job was integrating that sound library into Doom. But on Quake, I did my own sound engine from the ground up. That was, I think, one of the earlier things I started banging on for Quake. I wandered off the ports as soon as possible. The Jaguar thing was kind of traumatic for me. Like I said, loved working with Bobby, Doug figuring out how MIDI sequences, MIDI works. But I wanted back on the PC.
Well, as you mentioned Quake there as well, that was an amazing title, and it had some involvement with Nine Inch Nails as well. So what was the kind of idea behind that and porting the sound to that?
That was really fun. So I ended up getting to hang out with Trent a couple times. I guess I went on the tour bus with him from Dallas down to Austin and hung out at his house for a while. It was a little bit like the pitch to my dad of like, I'll use the Apple II for useful things. And I think American McGee was basically saying, hey, we're going to have this important time with Trent, and that'll matter. And Dave's doing the sound code, and Trent's doing the sound. So therefore, yes, right? But of course, in reality, we were just like, you know, I want to hang out with this dude. We were all listening to his music, which was incredible. And it turns out he was a huge Doom fan. But he really wanted to, I think he was a little disappointed with having me as the little hanger on. I think he was really wanting to get Carmack to hang out more. That was fun, but really didn't interact too much with him for the actual integrating the sounds. Like I said, I was mostly focused on the sound engine. Although, I don't know, this is stuff where I'm sort of misremembering things. My friend just told me that my sound code is still in the Quake engine, which it doesn't sound right to me. I'm pretty sure Carmack wrote huge chunks of it, but I smoked a lot of weed between then and now. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, no, today, Doom, it's almost become a meme, you know. It's a saying online, like, you know, can it run Doom? And we've seen it running on everything from, you know, microwaves to a pregnancy tester. I think we saw it running really? On a couple of years ago. Yeah, it's on everything these days.
The pregnancy tester.
Do you find it, like, you know, crazy that that kind of thing happens and just, like, you know, how iconic Doom's become in the last, like, 25 years?
That no, kind of you know what? I find it beautiful. Been proud of very few things in my career, but I'm very proud of having pushed hard both to get Doom on the various Unixes, and I'm very proud to have pushed open sourcing Doom at the company. And because code wants to be open sourced, right? It's a much more useful thing when you open source it. And there's a very, very good reason that Epic open sourced the Unreal Engine, right? It is a superior approach. And, you know, really it's less about Doom being ported to everything. And it's more about just, it happened to be one of the first commercial games that was ever open sourced, right? And once you open source it, I don't care what it is, like, people are going to want to port it to everything, right? Just because, especially if you make it, you know, sort of portable. Like, if you're going to port that to a pregnancy test, I'm telling you, that's not a fun port, man. Like, somebody had to work their ass off on that. Some of the ports I've seen are just incredible. And they really shouldn't be called ports. They should be called, what we called anyway, conversions, which is basically port implies, okay, well, I just need to change out the IO level stuff. But conversion means, like, so you've got to do a ton of work on this thing to make it happen.
And as well, I remember Doom getting open sourced, and that would have been like, it was 1997. So in terms of, you know, it wasn't all that long after the game came out. You know, there are games like Grand Theft Auto 5 came out 10 years ago. They're still selling that. But, you know, so that was relatively recent after the release. And I remember then, you know, I said all my friends who sold their Amigas, I remember a version coming out on the Amiga in 97 when it got open sourced. What was kind of the conversation around that then? And how did the idea kind of come about that they should put the source code out there, you know, just a few years after the game was, I imagine, still selling commercially?
Yeah, I mean, so I had left before that they actually open sourced it. I'm not sure I remember all this correctly. I just remember more like being kind of, you know, I had come into this atmosphere where they had the, you know, only probably the only game developers in the world with the good sense to use Next Step at the time, right? But I could also tell that most of the company was really unfamiliar with, like, the whole Unix-y world and the open source world. So I felt a little bit like a kind of, you know, sort of an ambassador for that space. And so I was trying to expose them to the game greats in that world, like NetTrek, which was, I believe it was a 16 simultaneous multiplayer game, you know, that was out well before Doom. And was incredible. It was client server based. It had character classes, essentially. It was incredibly fun. And I remember showing them that. And because it didn't have those kind of like amazing commercial graphics, it sort of landed with a thud, right? Because it was hard to see in that spectrum for them. But that was something I was always doing. I was always kind of like evangelizing that kind of world.
you ended up founding like crack.com, and that was really interesting. I thought abuse was a great little title. And you know, do you think it not being 3D and being a kind of side scroller meant the industry kind of you know, didn't embrace it massively, whereas the gamers did?
I honestly don't know. Like, I got quite a bit of love from the industry for it. I actually got unprecedentedly lovely publishing terms for it. The thing that didn't really work out with abuse is that it was a platformer on the PC, which was a big no-no back then. That was the wrong genre. That it really belonged on a console if it was a platformer. So that was our big mismatch for as far as like doing gangbusters on sales. But yeah, it was pretty generally beloved. I was frankly surprised at how many people would come up to me and saying, "Oh my God, I loved Abuse," as opposed to Doom or Quake.
It was ported on so many platforms. I'm reading that it was on the Acorn Archimedes. I remember it on Amiga OS, OpenBSD as well, Mac OS. Yeah, so it seemed to kind of have that code where it could, you know, be converted or ported onto a different platform relatively easily.
We actually did the porting deal with Bungie for the Mac, and they actually did the port, if I recall. And because they had such a great relationship with Apple, Abuse actually shipped on every iMac for a while. Those days wouldn't last long for games.
And I love the kind of way that it was like, you know, keyboard and mouse as well, but for a side scroller.
Yeah, and, no, is it?
Yeah, I, kind of unique interface.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of the few things that I get really passionate about in game design is user interface. And we spent a fair bit of time kind of iterating on that. But the original game actually, so Abuse is actually kind of an aborted fetus of a game. So the original game was called Alien Gru, and it was a side-scrolling brawler that had this really advanced real AI, like neural net AI, with a morphing rendering engine that my brilliant partner Jonathan Clark had written. It was kind of coming together, but I had paired them up with this brilliant sci-fi author named Stephen R. Donaldson to do the plot, who was really good at doing sort of anti-heroes, really dark stories. And he was writing the first comedy I'd ever seen from him, and it was brilliant writing, but he kept changing the gameplay mechanics, and I just couldn't keep up with him. The original story was aliens are invading, and you're an IRS agent. And the way that aliens are invading is that they've secretly put a mutagen into the IRS 1040 forms. And when people handle them to pay their taxes, they turn into aliens, right? We couldn't really keep up with it. The AI training algorithm was really hard to figure out. And so what could we do with the tech we've come up with and feel like a game we could make in our sleep? And we were like, well, you know, a side scroller, and what if we did this cool aiming thing with the mouse? I was a huge fan of this old coin-op game. I can't remember the name now, that had this two directional joysticks, one for aiming, one for moving. It just seemed like a cool idea to do it with the mouse.
It was a really cool looking game as well, actually. And it fit nicely into that kind of alien theme and just the darkness about it. Really beautiful.
Again, all tributes to Jonathan and Murray and Jung. Murray had done some beautiful art direction. Jung had really kind of fleshed it out wonderfully in this amazing design. And Jonathan had just done this amazing real-time lighting engine. Like, in so many ways, the Abuse engine was just way ahead of its time. He just did a fantastic job.
And you ended up kind of releasing the source code at the end. And why was that decision made? Because I know it was shareware originally, which is kind of the same model as Doom.
Same kind of model. Like I'm just a big open source weenie, and so it was really important to me to get it out there as open source. I think I can't remember exactly when we did it, But we decided to release it public domain as opposed to under a license. But there were parts that we held back, like we didn't give up the trademark. We didn't own the sound effects, I want to say, because those were Bobby Prince's. And we also didn't release the copyrights on the what are called the registered levels, right? So the part of the shareware game that you buy, right? So, but we released a chunk of it. And then I think it was Sam Lantinga who picked it up and really kind of ran with it. And I said, as long as it's for this, then yeah, you can use the trademark and all that stuff. And as long as it's for the open source version and it remains free, it's not, you know, commercialized.
Except, you know, shareware, I think, was an interesting model. And obviously, you know, originally I remember it was, you know, make a donation if you like the game, and then it became into, you know, more of a model of we'll give you extra content if you register. And then that kind of turned into, you know, licenseware and we've got donationware and that kind of thing. Do you think there's still a place for, like, you know, the shareware kind of model in modern gaming?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, these things where you basically say, hey, pay what you think it's worth.
Yeah.
It really depends on circumstances whether that's going to work, right? I remember I was doing a lawn sale. My friend Naomi and I stayed out all day selling this stuff on the lawn. And then it was getting late. We wanted to have dinner. And I had the idea, well, what if we just put a sign on there and say, take what you like, pay what you think it's worth, slip it under the door of apartment 3, right? And we went to dinner thinking, yeah, this stuff's all going to be gone. We're going to see 50 cents under there. And sure enough, it was mostly gone, but for the dregs. But to our shock, we came back and there was just a pile of money under the door. And I was really impressed by that. So it's not just something that works in, you know, software. It really, I think, can work in lots of things.
Well, one later title that you did that I absolutely adore was Lord of the Rings Battle for Middle-earth. What was your kind of involvement in that title?
Oh, very brief. It was a 3-week contracting gig. They needed help optimizing the GPU performance. And so I was talking to NVIDIA and basically sort of instrumenting the code and trying to get all of the DirectX calls under one module. So unlike Doom or Quake, where we had everything very carefully placed in a handful of modules for all the display calls, Battle for Middle-earth had inherited an engine. I think it was the Command and Conquer Generals engine originally, which if you've played that game is not the starting engine you would think was used for Battle for Middle-earth. And it kind of turned into this Franken engine, you know, it was really kind of all over the place. That was the middle that I don't know if you recall, but that was actually the game over which the EA spouse dispute came up that really changed labor laws in the game industry. And I was struck by the misery of this poor team that had been on sort of a forced, you know, crunchy death march. And they were buying these Jamba Juice things, and then they were buying meals for them. And they basically wouldn't let them go home. And I remember my boss was trying to get me to play ball with this, and I just wasn't having it. And I felt really bad for these guys. One of the things the coders did that really kind of struck me is, you know, those really thick rubber bands? They would walk up behind each other and just beam each other in the back with them. And that was considered good fun. Ouch. It struck me as the sort of thing that you might do in like a sensory deprivation tank, like when you're just crying out for any sensation, like pain is fine. Just give me something to distract me from this horror.
Sounds like kind of a torturous environment.
It really was. And I remember at the end of the day, they would have a play session where you'd try the game for a little while, and then you'd go into a meeting and you'd give feedback. And I was sort of thrust in the middle of this. And I was like, well, wait a minute, this game's no fun. Why are we, there was very much of missing the forest for the trees. Like, I found this bug, I found that bug. It's like, well, but this shit isn't fun. This is broken, right? And so I brought this stuff up and was very quickly shut down. And I was like, this whole place just feels like it's on a bad path, you know?
Yeah, we could kind of tell that, like, as gamers. So I was a huge fan of RTS and that kind of concept, but, you know, that you play multiplayer and you get to a point with hundreds of units and you get ready to go into your battle and then it would crash. You've done all this working to kind of build up your whole huge armies, go into battle, and then it just couldn't handle it. And it just
And this is just a non-starter. I was like, this is a... And I felt with all the pressure and the just the bitter mood that there wasn't much I could do there. And I really just wanted out. I think I can't even, I think I sort of pushed myself out after 3 weeks. I can't even remember, but I wanted nothing to do with it because the whole scene and the poor guy who brought me in, I love the dude to death, but I could tell he felt like he was sort of stuck in this middle of this morass as well. You know, some games are just like that. Like, you know, you can work your ass off on a great game or you can work your ass off on a really troubled game, and it's like almost more work on the troubled game, just way less satisfying. And I smelled that.
Well, one game that I hope you've got, you know, nicer memories of, Karateka. I mean, that was obviously, you know, kind of, you know, the precursor to Prince of Persia. You know, Jordan Mechner, were you a fan of his work originally, and how did you get involved with the Steam remake of that game?
I was a huge, huge fan of the original. Huge. Like, it was such a cool Zen experience. It was a permadeath game. It was so challenging. I loved how he brought together the code and the design and the art and the music so deliciously. Like, having programmed on the Apple II, it really made you appreciate like how challenging everything was and what a perfect Zen piece of art it was, you know? And I got to know him when I came down here to start Carbon 6 with American. And I started becoming a friend of his now ex-wife. She was doing photography. I was studying acting as a hobby and was happy to play digestible protein in front of her camera, you know? And then I got to talking to Jordan saying, man, you know, Karateka was so good, and really just started lobbying him to remake it and finally got him to agree. And so we, you know, went off on that adventure together, raising money and coming up with the design, finding teams and stuff like that. So I came on ostensibly as sort of a rep, like I'll try to help put together the money and team and whatever help you want with the design. Yeah, I wasn't expecting to help with the design. I ended up coming up with that idea of starting off with the true love, and then if he failed, then it's the monk who loves her a little less, and then after him it's the brute if he fails. It kind of turned into a more of a producing role, and it really I ended up doing things that I wasn't terribly good at, and I was really, I've always thought of myself more as a hey baby producer. Like, I'm not a terribly, like, don't ask me to make budgets and schedules and to crack whip on people. I'm not that kind of producer. I think I'm more of a cheerleader and putting things together kind of guy. Anyway, so it, you know, it was a great learning experience for me. I didn't really like how it turned out in the end. One of the key things I thought was missing was that in the original, I don't know if you remember, but it was very sensitive to the distance from which you were from your opponent and how your blows landed, depending on that, and then where they were in their attack and how you could sort of block a kick, for example. And all that was lost on the new one. Really, you were either within combat range or not within combat range. It was kind of a binary thing. And I thought a lot of the dimensionality of the gameplay left with that. And it felt much less kind of sort of Zen to me, you know, that magic from the original, some of that had gone away.
And the fact that there was like lives in there and that the difficulty felt toned down as well, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I take full blame for that. I thought that doing a permadeath thing just wouldn't be tenable during that market. So we had to have some way for you to win, but in a less satisfying way, so that you would want to replay it and win with her true love. But really, I wasn't the guy in charge. It really was Jordan. I was just helping to facilitate stuff. And really, I made as much of a mess as I did help. Like, one of the first things, we worked on site at the developer, which was kind of we really kind of upended their management chain, because Jordan Mechner is kind of a rock star in the game industry. So it's like sitting next to Brad Pitt, you're constantly wanting to push up your bra kind of and show them the sexy things you're working on. And I was in through my mind was like, let's spend nickels like manhole covers. I want to spend as little money as possible on as ugly a game as possible. That's really fun. So that, once we've nailed that, we can sex it up and that sort of thing. So the first thing I did was talk to the leads and basically say, hey, how can we get you not working on this game so that we don't have as high a burn rate? And, that went over great. I think one or two leads left within the first week of meeting me and realizing that I was going to be a mess. So it was, eventually I was working on stuff that it just wasn't me. Like, hey, Dave, take care of all the ratings agencies all over the world, the ESRB and the PEGI and all the, like, whatever they use in Brazil and Japan. And it was just like, do not sick Dave on these things. This is not a fit for me. So I think it was in the depths of our Sony kind of stuff, where I was like, I'm checking out, guys. This is not me.
Well, Dave, it's been incredible reminiscing with you over the last hour or so, the highs and lows of your career. I mean, what are you up to these days then? What are you working on right now?
I am currently the CTO of a company called Blue Vishnu, and we do 3D textured meshes, full body scans. So our sort of superpowers is that, are that we can do extremely high turnaround scans. So we just were at South by Southwest with the Tezos blockchain guys. And I think it was over 200 full body scans. One of those days, I think over three days or so, we did over 500 scans, start to finish, from to publishing them as NFTs on this low power blockchain. So I'm still banging on that, and I'm helping a friend out with sort of a slow burn game dev, which he hasn't announced, but I will certainly make noise when he's ready to do that.
Well, Dave, listen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your stories with us. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure, man.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.